So, Brett, I appreciate you coming on Solid Faith Podcast today to talk to me, and just really an honor to have you on the program.
Hey, I'm looking forward to this conversation, Clark.
Absolutely. So I wanted to give my listeners a little bit of a background as to your work, and some of them are probably already familiar with your work and your book with John Stone Street. We'll talk about that book today. But for those who aren't aware maybe of your background, I'll let you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your organization, Maven.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the church. My parents got saved when I was a baby, and they were on fire. They got us plugged into a really good Southern Baptist church when I was a little kid. Was involved in every children's program you can imagine. In junior high and high school, I got involved in my youth group. We were just completely plugged in. I was a student leader. And then I went off to college, and my freshman year in college, I met a philosophy professor, David Lane, who through a semester of philosophy 101 just kind of dismantled my faith. And that made me go back and question everything. And it made me wonder why for the first 18 years of my discipleship in the church, I wasn't equipped. I wasn't equipped to answer these challenges to God, to the scriptures. I mean, there were just all kinds of skeptical objections he was raising, and I had no clue. I hadn't heard these things before. And so that through that whole process, God woke me up really to apologetics. And I think apologetics then was a doorway to the larger Christian worldview and just good Christian thinking. So I was in youth ministry at the time. I was actually doing an internship and eventually became the junior high pastor at my church. And I thought, oh my gosh, here are all these kids like me who were growing up in the church. We hadn't adequately prepared them. In 3, 4, 5 years, they're going to be in the same situation I'm in, and we've got to prepare them. So in youth ministry, I just started pouring into my kids in terms of, you know, them knowing what they believe and why they believe it and having a solid theological foundation, because I knew that's the world we're sending them into. And through that process, realized the church in general, I think, is not doing a good job. I mean, I spent 11 years in youth ministry and saw very little effort to equip kids kind of in a large scale way, you know, kind of across the board in youth ministry. I felt like a lot of youth ministry was just very entertainment driven and very shallow. And so through that, I decided, hey, I need to do something about this. Ended up joining a great apologetics ministry called Stand to Reason, spent 14 years there. And then eventually was just really sensed the need to really focus on youth, focus also on the people who disciple youth, so parents and youth leaders and pastors, and to really help lay a foundation of the Christian worldview. So to do some really good apologetics, but to kind of expand beyond that and to really engage culture more with the Christian worldview in a very holistic way. So that led us to starting Maven about 2.5 years ago, and have been at it ever since.
Yeah, the book that we're going to talk about today is sort of that in a nutshell. It's a practical guide to culture. So you've taken apologetics and now given parents and youth pastors and youth leaders the tools to engage this next generation. And I found the book is very useful. I've used it myself to teach teenagers myself, or, you know, to have those difficult conversations, answer those difficult questions that our culture brings up. So I want to talk about that book today. I guess first and foremost, what made you want to write the practical guide to our current culture today?
Well, I had 5 main reasons I wanted to write this book. Their names are Alexis, Micah, Paige, Ella, and Jonah. Those are my 5 kids. Those are the primary kids that God has entrusted my wife and I with to disciple and to raise. I mean, you could say that's my youth group now. And they motivate me. I want to prepare my kids, and I want to be able to send them out with confidence that they're not just going to hold on to their faith by the skin of their teeth or just survive or walk away. I want to be able to equip my kids in a way that I feel like they're I feel confident that they will be able to navigate culture and the challenges, college, whatever it is, they'll be able to navigate that well. So they are really the primary reason that I wanted to write this book, because I'm always thinking about this kind of stuff and trying to think, how best do I equip my own kids? And then just, of course, after that is just having a heart for the church. I think spending the first years of ministry in local church ministry is always just given me a heart to see the local church equipped, because the local church is God's plan A, right? And, I think parachurch ministries like Maven are important, seminaries, Christian education, that's all important. But I think the church is the primary vehicle through which Jesus wants to disciple the nations. And so we wanted to just kind of secondarily come alongside the parents and leaders and the church and equip them to really think through these things so that they can help disciple their own kids in a very deep and robust and holistic way.
Yeah, talking to parents as well, I get the sense from a lot of parents of they feel discouraged by everything they see in the culture and in the media. And you see the deconstruction of those who had Christian faith for a long time and people that were popular in the culture deconstructing their faith. And I wonder what you would say to encourage Christians who may want to disengage from the culture altogether and pump the brakes and say, we're just going to just hide out in our church or disengage from all that. What would you say to those parents and to those youth leaders?
I guess I might say, wake up. wake up. That's not even an option. Yeah. And with those Christians, I don't know, maybe we need to be a little more harsh, maybe harsh is not the right word, but a little more direct and forward and speak some truth and say, that's not biblical whatsoever. That kind of approach to kind of withdraw from the world around us is not a biblical approach. Ultimately, we are not just saved from the world, we're saved for the world. And this is one of the things that John and I talk about in this book. Like, what are we saved for? We have a whole chapter on this. Yes, salvation, when we're redeemed by Christ, there's forgiveness of sins, there is a sanctification. There's also, I think, this calling in a broad sense to then go back and to, do good and beautiful things in the world and to proclaim the truth and to proclaim the gospel and to preserve good things in culture and all of this. I mean, you can go back to Genesis 1 and the cultural mandate. So this is just not even an option for us to withdraw. So if that's the tendency, I'd say a couple things. Number one, you might want to go back and just read your Bible. Yeah. Read the book of Acts. Think about it. I think Christians who want to withdraw need to have some perspective, study some church history, and go back to the first century. And really, the challenges that we face, while I think it, I think it's, we're permitted to lament and to be sad about some of those things. There's certainly evil out there. But if you're a Christian in the United States or in a lot of Western kind of culture, look, we have it better than probably 99% of the Christians who have gone before us. Yeah. So we need some perspective on this. And then the other issue is the fact that, and I hear this from Christians where there's this kind of despair. You know, there's a little bit of hopelessness in their voices when they see the culture. And sometimes I think there's this idea like we need to return to the good old days back when we were a quote unquote Christian culture. That's in some ways a mistaken idea. There's no culture that's ever been thoroughly Christian, because you have culture created and made up of a bunch of fallen human beings. Now, are there aspects of culture that certainly can be more consistent and fit more with the Christian worldview? Absolutely. But what we ought to expect is that every culture at all times, in all places, are fallen, filled with fallen people, and are going to be filled with evil, and going to be filled with sin. And so that's why we don't put our hope in human culture. That's why we don't put our hope in the state, in, you know, human governments or political leaders. Mm. Our hope is, you know, squarely in Christ. And I think with that perspective, Christ as the anchor, then our perspective and our posture should always be one of hope. And so if you're not hopeful, if you're constantly despairing, you may need to go back and study your Bible. You may need to go back and look at Christ. You may need to go back and just do some reevaluation.
Right. Yeah. You know, we had Hilary Farrar on, and she wrote a book, Mama Bear Apologetics, and she talked about sort of the method of engaging with the culture that, you know, instead of deeming the culture as wholesale evil and hiding from the culture, what are some of the good things you can pull out to your students or to your kids and say, hey, you know, this is a positive thing versus all of it being there? Because I think what happens with students especially is they see a truth embedded with something that's quote unquote secular, and they say, well, that's true, and I've been told that that's all wholesale bad or evil, and there's some truth in there. So I guess my next question is, what is the current state of cultural affairs? Is it all bad, or are there some redeemable aspects of today's cultural norms that we can point to and say, okay, the entire culture is not dead and gone and bad and terrible and evil. There's some things that we can pull out and say, yeah, we agree on this, although our starting point may be different. We agree on certain things. So what are some of the redeemable aspects of today's culture?
Yeah, well, I think if we step back and we do our anthropology well, meaning we have a biblical view of man, what we should expect is that there are going to be evil, broken, ugly parts of culture because of our fallen human nature. And at the same time, there's going to be some beautiful aspects because we're made in the image of God. In fact, this is a great thing to narrate for our kids and for our young people, is to help them see how the Christian worldview and Christian truth, the Christian view of man, actually has tremendous explanatory power. Because on one end, you have the genocide, the killing, whatever. I mean, think of any evil out there and the depth of it. And it's hard to imagine that human beings are capable of such evil. But then at the same time, you look at these amazing civilizations. You think about the arts, for instance, and you think about a Bach or a Beethoven or a Da Vinci, or, you know, these amazing masters, these artists, and you think about civilizations and all the good that, you know, that we see, and all the beauty and all the, you know, the wonder. And it's like, what makes sense of this? Human beings can do this and they can do this at the same time. Well, the Christian worldview explains that. And so I think your question is so good, because what it forces us to do is to look back in the culture, and rather than dismiss it wholesale, we can look and point to beautiful things that image bearers, whether they're redeemed or not, that image bearers have created and produced. So I think there's some good movies out there. Mm. I always, since my kids have been young and, you know, have enjoyed, you know, children's movies, one example is the movies by Pixar. You know, Pixar movies are really well done. So they're beautiful works of art, if you will, in terms of movie making. But they also are filled with goodness, right? There's these moral virtues. I think there was trying to remember the author's name. I think it's Randy Velarde, who wrote a book called, I think it's The Virtues of Pixar, where he highlights these, you know, in the different stories. For instance, something like Toy Story, where you have this band of friends and there's this deep loyalty and friendship that really is portrayed so beautifully and is held up as this, you know, this really good virtue, and virtues of courage you know, all these kind of things. So that's, you know, that would be an example of the kind of thing that we could point to and hold up in front of our kids and say, not only is this thing beautiful and well done, it's not cheesy Christian art, right? We don't have very good examples of a lot of the stuff that's coming out of the Christian world, but it's beautiful. It promotes goodness, and there are true messages in there: truth, goodness, beauty, coming from unbelievers. You know, because they're made in the image of God. You know, and so I think those are the kind of things that we would want to point to. So you know, and it could be any realm where you'll see this. So for instance, we look at the coronavirus pandemic that we're in, and you have a bunch of great examples and individual stories of healthcare workers who are on the front lines, who are risking their own lives. So that you just see these, maybe some virtues, like the virtue of courage, you know, putting yourself in a situation where you're exposed to, you know, the virus, and you put yourself in danger, you put your loved ones in danger, but you're willing to do that. You have the courage to do that because, you know, of your, you know, your views of other people or what have you. And those are examples that we can hold up in the culture. So it just takes a little more work sometimes. It's easy to see all the bad stuff because there's plenty of it, but we also want to look at the good stuff, and those things give us glimmers of hope. You know, they help us to see that hey, these are image bearers, and all that stuff, even as an unredeemed image bearer, that stuff can point back to a beautiful God as the source of truth, goodness, and beauty.
Right. Yeah. You know, I attended, I told you before we got on here live, but I attended a conference where you were speaking, and you talked about some of the ways that you would bring young people to engage with people of different worldviews. And I found that to be really fascinating. I thought it was really interesting, you know, taking students into territories that, you know, may be a little more hostile, if that's even the right word, for our Christian faith. And so you would take students to Berkeley or, you know, a place like that, where it's not traditionally a Christian setting. So I wonder if you could expound on some of the exercises that you've used as both a youth leader and as a parent to, you know, help the next generation engage the culture, engage, you know, people face to face with differing worldviews.
Yeah, well, I think this is a real, it's probably a missing part in our discipleship of young people. And even if you're on board with, you know, Christian worldview training and apologetic training and good biblical and theological training, you know, oftentimes it stops there. So we teach the what, we teach the why. And I think the third part we need to add to that is we need to teach the how to. And so particularly by the time kids are in high school, at the least, what we want to do is we want to do more things that get them out of a classroom, out from behind the four walls of the church, and we want to get this stuff into real life. And that was really, as a youth pastor, when I was training my young people, I was constantly looking for ways for them to engage the world so that this wasn't just stuff that kind of, you know, sat up in the mind, but they actually brought it into real life. They brought it into real conversations. They got to see how this stuff, how ideas have consequences, how they work themselves out in everyday life. So as a youth pastor, what I would do is, if I would maybe study a world religion, we would make sure that we would try to, we would do some homework and look around and see, is there somebody from that particular religion that we can engage with? So for instance, we did a 3-week series on Buddhism, and before the series, you know, I kind of laid it out. We're gonna teach the students what Buddhists believe, kind of lay out the Buddhist system. Then we're going to do some critique. We're going to do a biblical critique. How does this match up with scripture? How does this match up with the Christian worldview? And then we're going to do an apologetic critique. What are the problems with Buddhism historically? What are some of the internal inconsistencies? All, you know, do all that good stuff. And then at the end of that, we were going to create basically a field trip. And there was a huge Buddhist temple that was about 25 minutes away from our church. And so I called them up and I arranged for a Buddhist monk to give our junior hires at our church a tour of the Buddhist temple. Now, of course, we did the training first, because my philosophy was give them the truth first, give students the truth first, ground them in the truth, and then expose them to error. Like, we don't want to overwhelm them with the error without being equipped. So We then took them to the Buddhist temple. They had 3 weeks of training, and then they got to see face to, you know, they got to talk face to face with a Buddhist monk, a real Buddhist monk, and he answered their questions, and they walked around the huge Buddhist temple, and he got to explain things, and I mean, these students, you just watch them kind of come alive. And we're dealing with, you know, some pretty intellectual things for junior hires. And then afterwards, we would always debrief these things and help, you know, the kids see, you know, what they had just seen, kind of review the game film, if you will. And so we'd always do a debrief. And man, these students were just, you couldn't get them to shut up. And that's all, I mean, that's all, normally a problem with junior hires. But they were talking about, you know, apologetics. They were talking about world religions. And that's the kind of thing we need to do more of. At home, as a parent, I, you know, whenever I get a knock at the door and I open up the door and there's Jehovah's Witnesses standing there or Mormon missionaries standing there, man, I make it a point to set up, you know, an appointment for them to come back and to sit down with my whole family and make sure that my kids are there, because this is a great opportunity to have my kids, you know, engage. And, you know, when we're looking, if we're teaching on the afterlife, it's easy to find a graveyard or cemetery in your city and maybe to talk about eternity, but then go and sit in a graveyard where you're surrounded by, you know, human corpses that are buried, of course. But these kinds of things, I think, and getting creative with it and just getting this stuff out of the classroom and into real life situations really helps bring it to life. And we've seen that through our immersive experiences. We do, you mentioned the immersive experience trip we do to Berkeley that focuses on apologetics. You know, we go up to Berkeley because there's all kinds of atheists and secularists and all kinds of people who really will challenge what you believe. And we just basically figure out ways to put the students on these immersive experience trips. We just find out ways to put them in situations where they have to talk to unbelievers. And they inevitably get challenged. And what happens is they'll say, oh yeah, that classroom lecture I had or that book that I read, I thought I knew that argument, but then I just talked to the skeptical Berkeley student on Berkeley's campus and he just thrashed me. And what that does then is creates motivation for them. They come back and say, hey, help me learn this argument better. I thought I knew it, but I don't. And then they go back out the next day and they re-engage and they really begin to internalize that stuff. And they really grow in their knowledge.
Your approach is so interesting because I think so many people are actually fine with studying apologetics or philosophy as long as they don't have to go put it into practice. And so when you get out there and you find out really what you know is it comes to the light or comes to the surface when you're talking to someone who disagrees. So I, you know, oftentimes I can write an essay or I can pass a test or I can, but when I'm in a face-to-face conversation with someone about an issue where we disagree, you really find out what you know and what you don't know. So I think it's the ultimate test, really, and it's not being done enough in our churches. And I don't feel like this is something that a lot of churches are practicing even, or even a ton of youth ministries are practicing. But I would really encourage, if you're listening, and especially if you're a youth pastor, but if you're a parent as well, I mean, you talked about how you do this as a father, you know, in your own home. I mean, this is something that anyone can do, but it just takes that courage to engage, you know, engage people that are, you know, from a totally different lifestyle or worldview. You know, we talked earlier about movies. I'm a huge fan of films and music as well. I love music. Unfortunately, the harsh reality is a lot of the strictly Christian, you know, art is not my favorite personally. I find a lot of it to be lacking in skill and, you know, things that I enjoy. And so, but at the same time, we don't have to reject entertainment wholesale. There's sort of a balance I think you can have. And probably as a parent, there's not a one size fits all. Each family is going to have to find that balance. But I wonder if you could apply a similar approach that you take in these face-to-face conversations with how you engage with music, media, entertainment. What does that look like, you know, as a parent? What kind of conversations do you have with your kids about the movies that you watch, and how do you watch films as a parent? And and maybe give listeners tips on how to do that, how to engage the culture
Yeah.
through music and through films.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to maybe look at the different stages of kind of child development, right, if you will, and a kid's moral development. So, as I kind of my wife and I kind of conceptualize this, we really think, and just from our study and our research, I think there's kind of three distinct stages. You have the elementary ages, and you could just say, let's say 0 to 4th grade or 5th grade. And at this stage, there's a couple things I think that are important. Number one, protection. There's a lot of protection that you have to give at those younger ages that are it's appropriate because our kids aren't ready to engage the culture like an adult is. And so early on, there's a lot of protection, and then you're teaching a lot of just Christian truth. So the idea is there's protection so that I can pour into them Christian truth. And that's the first stage of discipleship. I would say by the time they are in 5th and 6th grade, what you're going to see in your kids, and it'll emerge earlier, and you know, again, kids are different. So you may have a first grader who's begins asking these questions, but really by the time they're in middle school and junior high, as their minds develop, they learn to think abstractly. They begin asking the why questions, not just the what questions anymore, but the why. And they want to know how things work, and they want to know are there good reasons for things. And this is really in we look at what's called classical education. You know, this is referred to as the logic stage. And what you want to do in this stage is really teach your kids how to think, because ultimately you want them to think for themselves. So you give them the tools of thinking, you teach them logic, you teach them apologetics. You don't get threatened by their why questions, you engage those why questions and you don't shut them down. And then you know, then in that high school age is kind of the general categorization. That is where then in their moral development, hopefully they're grounded in the truth, they're grounded in good reasoning, and then they're ready to engage. You know, with guidance as well, and really having models in front of them is very helpful at that age. So apply that then to entertainment and movies and music. I think early on we have to do a lot of protection. You know, if you're a parent or a youth pastor, I mean, just you know, go to iTunes or iMusic or you know whatever platform you use, and just figure out, hey, what are the top 10 songs right now, or the top 5 songs. Get those songs, go search out the lyrics and read the lyrics. And pretty much any single day, the top 5 songs are going to give you an example, just a great illustration of how depraved things are out there. Okay. So that's why there's a lot of protection early on. But then, so what we've done with our kids is give them a lot of protection, but also help them to, in the process, put good stuff in front of them. Whether it's from quote unquote secular sources, right? We just want to put good music in front of our kids. And really, I think the, you know, in the mission of Maven, our mission is to equip the next generation with truth, goodness, and beauty. And those categories, you know, those transcendental categories are really the things that we use to evaluate, you know, something like music and movies. Is it are the messages that it's telling true? Is it promoting some goodness or virtue? And then is it well done, right? You can have movies that have a good message that promote some kind of moral virtue, but then they're just cheesy or they're horribly, they're just not well done. They're not good movies. And we want to bring all three of those things together and then put those examples in front of our kids. So one of the ways we help them evaluate is whenever, as our kids are younger and they hear songs maybe their friends are listening to, where there's a lot of focus on that truth and goodness aspect. So I would have my kids get online, print out the lyrics to a song, and while we're not listening to the song, but you know, there's no music to be distracted by, but we just sit down and we would read through the lyrics together. And then I would ask questions like, okay, what do you think the central theme of this song is? What's this song about? What's the message that's being conveyed? And we just kind of chew on it together. And of course, oftentimes when they're younger, I'm having to unpack that for them. I'm having to teach, you know, do more of the teaching. But as they get older, I'm kind of sitting back and pushing them to say, hey, I want you to learn how to discover this message for yourself, ultimately, so that you can discern and make a decision whether or not you want this or you want to put this in your life or not. And so that's kind of the process. So a lot of protection up front, but then you start letting go a little bit and you let them engage. And you know, and this is the analogy that we use in the book, in the introduction to the book. It's like surfing. Like when I wanted to teach my kids how to surf, I didn't just throw them in the ocean. Well, if you want to teach your kid to engage the culture, you can't just throw them in the culture. There are steps that you take. And the first step is protection. I protected my kids from the ocean because I want them to surf. That seems a little ironic, but we all know a kid can drown very quickly. And so they needed to be prepared to face those bigger waves one day. And the long-term goal was that they would be able to surf by themselves. The long-term goal in the culture is that my kids will navigate the culture on their own, but I've got a careful process of getting them there, especially when it comes to entertainment and movies. And so, you know, one thing that we do sometimes with the kids is, you know, pause movies as we go along. We'll watch a movie together as a family, and then we're kind of pausing it. Or you know, sometimes you just definitely don't want to do that too much because kids will not want to watch movies with you anymore. you know, but afterwards, just always having conversations about the movies and the themes and that kind of stuff. So those are some of the things, you know, I think we need to be doing as parents and leaders.
Yeah. And I teach a film and apologetics class. So every time I watch a movie with my wife, man, she gets so tired of hearing about the philosophy in every movie and, you know, what's going on in The Matrix or Inception and all that. So I totally can relate to that.
I think guys like, you know, maybe you and me who are a little more, have a more of an apologetics bent, it's good for us to spend time around people who are a little more artistic.
Yeah.
And who can help us maybe set aside all the evaluation, because, you know, you and I want to always get into that aspect of it. But we need some coaching in the aesthetic, you know, components and how to enjoy something that's beautiful without always analyzing it to pieces. And that more artistic person needs help from us to do more of that analysis. So we need all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one of the bands that you recommended in your book, 21 Pilots, has been a band that's been on my playlist since I read the book. I hadn't really listened to them much, but at that time I listened to them. And then when you hear the lyrics, you know, whatever you think about 21 Pilots, but when you read the lyrics of their songs, it's very, very powerful and definitely brings a positive worldview to the table. So, you know, things like that, there's so many good resources out there. I wonder what you would say to parents that are afraid their child may be always in front of a screen. You know, I see that a lot now, especially the younger generation. Growing up, I was on a skateboard. I was outside. I was playing basketball, anything but a screen. But I see now this generation being more addicted to screens. So what are some practical steps that maybe parents could take or even youth pastors could recommend for protecting their kids in this technological age?
Yeah, I think screens are omnipresent, and there's a lot of good that comes with screens. I mean, the fact that you and I are able to do an interview like this and then send it out into the internet and people can get equipped. I mean, this is one of the good things. So I think this is, again, where parents and leaders need to be careful not to say it's all bad and not to say no to, you know, to everything, but to help see the good redeeming qualities of something like this. At the same time, screens are constantly pushing. They're constantly pushing. In fact, this is one of the things I think for most Christians, they need to understand that technology is not neutral, right? It's always moving in a direction. If you think about a car has, you know, different drive gears where it's moving forward. You can put it in reverse, it's going backwards, and then it has a neutral gear where it's standing still. Technology doesn't have that gear. It doesn't have a neutral. Technology is always pushing. So that means when you use technology, just by our use of technology, it has the power to shape us and form us. And this is one of the reasons why we have to be very careful and thoughtful about technology. So just a real, I think, practical encouragement is that I think we in the church should be doing a lot of reflecting on technology, doing a lot of theological reflection on technology, developing our theology of technology. So number one, we need to be reading books. And of course, we have included some of that, you know, stuff on technology and entertainment in the Practical Guide to Culture. Andy Crouch has an excellent book called The TechWise Family. There's a brilliant lady, Kathy Cook, who wrote Screens and Teens. There's a lot of good books out there that I think parents ought to be at least once a year reading a book on technology so that they can help lead their families in this. Again, thinking about the different stages of development, I think early on what you want to do as a parent is to protect your kid as much as possible from the screen. I think very early on there should be very limited screen time. And in fact, you know, American Pediatrics Association, I think it is. They recommend not even putting a screen in front of your kid for the first 2 years of their life, right? And it has to do with brain development and cognitive, function and things like that. I think there's some wisdom there of doing everything you can early on, maybe those first 10 years of life, to limit screen time as much as possible, and even beyond. And there'll be plenty of time for screen time. It's constantly going to be calling and pushing out. So you want to, very early on, protect them as much as possible and help them to, number one, not develop early addictions to technology. So there's a very good protective element. But number two, you also want to be filling their lives with other things and helping them to develop other loves, you know, so that technology is just always, wooing and there's all these bells and whistles and it's always so loud and it's just constantly pulling. But there are other things that are not so flashy, but that are rich and deep and so much more soul satisfying than maybe, watching that YouTube video. Things like reading. So not only with our younger kids are we protecting them from technology, limiting screen time a ton, but what we're doing then is we're doing a lot of reading. Because one of the things we want our kids to leave our house with is a love of reading. And so we read books constantly. Now, we use technology actually to help our kids listen to books. So we will use Audible, and we have purchased hundreds of Audible books that our kids will listen to. My wife and I read to them all the time, and they're, reading on their own. And we, have lots of books around our house. And so we're not just taking away screen time, but we're trying to fill that with things that are better in a lot of ways. Music. So all of our kids are in, they're all in music lessons, and they're every day they have time where they're playing the piano, things like that. They're involved in athletics and sports. And so, we want them to develop other habits, and screen time, we just know that one's the easy one. It's not like we have to really work hard to get our kids on screens. Yeah. So I think there's a very protective element that we, early on. And then when they get into, junior high and high school, then what you're trying to help them do is develop self-control. And that's why I think that protection is helpful early on, because you want them to learn self-control first before you put this device in their hands that is highly addictive and that has highly addictive, social media apps and, those kind of things. And so, because ultimately at the end of the day, there's no comprehensive list of rules that I can lay out for my kid that's going to protect them from everything. It's going to, direct them perfectly on the right path. Ultimately, it's going to have to come down to their inner virtue and character. And so we've got to work on those things. And then here's a real practical example that we've done with our high school students. I've got two high schoolers in my house now, my son Micah and my daughter Paige, and they both have smartphones. And before they got smartphones, we created a 2-page smartphone contract. And that was a way to say, hey, here are mom and dad's thoughts on this. Here are the boundaries and guidelines and the reasons why. And we gave that to them. We said, hey, look it over. Add your input. If there's something you don't like, let us know. But we told them, hey, any rule you don't like, you just have to give us the reason why you think it's a bad rule. Mm. And if you can convince us, we'll get rid of it. If you have good reasons, then we'll get rid of that rule. Yeah. And so they had some ownership in that. And then eventually we agreed to it and said, okay, this is what we're going to live by. And they signed it, and we have them look at it every couple months to review it. And that then gives us, and I found it was really important to write it down, not just talk about it, but write it down so we could remember, we could go back to it and say, hey, remember these agreements? And you know, it's a constant revisiting of it. So those are, you know, those are some practical things that we do as parents.
Yeah. Yeah, we're wrapping up here, but I want to give you a chance to plug some of the things that you do over at Maven, because I think that would be a good place for parents to find some resources. So parents, youth pastors that want to learn more about what you do, and especially if they want to get the book, where can they get this book? Where can they learn more about Maven, your organization, and you know, some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah, well, the book is available at Amazon or any Christian bookseller online. In fact, we just, in January, a student version of the book came out. It's called A Student's Guide to Culture. I got it right here. It's got the blue cover. It's basically what we did is we included almost every single one of the same chapters from the adult version, except for one chapter, and just kind of did a parallel book for students. We youthitized it, so it's in a youth voice, you know, kind of took the stuff out that was just applicable for parents only, created the youth version so that parents and students could read the books together. Parent can read the practical guide, the student can read the student's guide, and that just a way to foster some conversation and discussion about, you know, some of these challenges. So that's one resource. Our website is maventruth.com, if you go to the website and find more about what we do these immersive experiences for youth groups. We lead groups of students to Berkeley on our apologetics trip. We have a biblical trip that really focuses on teaching kids theology and scripture. And we go to Utah and engage Mormons for that one. We actually have a worldview immersive experience as well that really takes the Christian worldview and says, hey, how does this play out in everyday life, whether you're a businessman or an artist or a politician or, you know, a stay-at-home mom, and it really tries to help young people connect their Christian worldview and Christian truth to everything that they do. So maventruth.com would be a place to find our resources. We have a parent podcast, actually, that my wife and I do that they can find at the website, or it's on, we have a YouTube page as well. They can just look up Maven. Okay. And find all our resources online.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll link all that up to our YouTube channel. And if you're listening by podcast, you know, we'll link all that up as well. But man, I really appreciate you taking some time out, and I really enjoyed the book. It was one of those game changing books. I, you know, as a youth pastor, I was able to use that as a resource to share with students who had a lot of questions. There's a lot of topics in the book that, you know, we just didn't have time to get to today that are just so at the top of the cultural heap right now. So, you know, the LGBTQ issues, the gender identity, the racial tension that's constantly, you know, brought up in today's media circles. These are all issues that I think parents should have good answers for, because our students and our kids are going to get those answers from somewhere, if not from us. So I really encourage parents to go out and get the book. And yeah, I really appreciate you giving us some time today, Brett. I enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, Clark. Keep up the good work, man.
All right. I pop a willy, you move. I pop a willy.